From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, a look way back at the early intersection of race and crime statistics. Then the Public Policy Forum looks at after-school programs and reaches a tough conclusion.
But bottom line is, if the purpose here is to ensure that parents are able to select highly rated programs, the fact is that there aren't many highly rated after-school providers in Milwaukee County.
Plus, Milwaukee puts a new method of community assessment to the test, and one dish that should make you forget what you thought you knew about ramen.
Sort of a decadent, almost milky broth that comes from a lot of the fat, the meat, and the bone. It's super delicious, you know, and you put noodles in there, and you have various additions to it, vegetables and so on, and it's a full meal.
Lake Effect is next, after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Nice to have you along this morning. Over a six-month period, WUWM and Lake Effect have been looking at the high rate of black male incarceration in the Milwaukee area and the impact it has on the community. We've taken a look at the current data showing that Wisconsin jails more of its black men than any other state in the country. But today, we're going to examine some older data. In fact, some of the first data ever collected about African Americans and crime. Writer Khalil Gibran Muhammad argues that that earliest of data shapes how society views blacks even today. Muhammad is the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library and author of the book The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. And he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Mitch, for having me. This is a real treat.
There were presumably not a lot of statistics and social science surrounding blacks prior to emancipation. So at what point did statistics even start being collected, and to what end were they aimed?
Oh, that's a great question. The earliest statistics to really document and say something meaningful about black people occurred as early as the 1870 census, which was the first census after 4 million formerly enslaved people could be recorded in a significant and meaningful way. Earlier census covered enslaved people, but they weren't used to comment on the health and welfare of this population. So it's really only at the moment, at the end of slavery, that census data becomes the basis for measuring the health and welfare of black people. And so much of what precedes the end of slavery is predicated on who black people really are. Are they actually capable of a term then used, statecraft? Can they help to lead the nation? Can they be productive citizens as free people? So it's not until the 1890 census, the first census to record black people that is considered authoritative. And it's also a generational moment because this census records the first African Americans who had not been born into slavery. And that said something meaningful because you could actually see how are black people doing without having been touched by, for people who had defended slavery, the beneficent hand of slavery itself.
They hadn't been technically touched by slavery itself, but that is not to say that slavery didn't shape who these people were.
Well, this is a demographic point. So if you're born in 1865, you've not been enslaved, literally. So someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, the first black Harvard-trained PhD, is born in 1868. So slavery has nothing to do essentially with his childhood. I mean, of course, the legacies of slavery is a slightly different way of putting it. And the circulation of ideas about black people as inferior, the early evidence of legalized segregation that comes to be known as Jim Crow are apparent. But just as a matter of a demographic claim, how many black babies are born? What do they die of? What kinds of diseases do black people get? All of those sort of indices of social welfare are predicated on this notion that a whole generation of black people were born into freedom.
Would you say that the initial work that purported to link black people with an innate criminality, if you will, was it explicitly rooted in racism, or would we just think of it as poor data analysis today?
Oh, it was explicitly rooted in racism. Actually, it turns out that one might think, looking back on this period, that the criminalization of African Americans was always there and a deliberate project, when in fact, the enslaved population, part of slavery was predicated on this notion that black people were a child race, that they were not sophisticated enough to actually commit some of the high crimes of the white race. And that means that the invention of the criminality of the race ties to statistics is worked out after slavery because there's a need to justify discrimination. There's a need to keep black people in a particular location in society. There's a need to expand the criminal justice system to simply coerce the actual practice and meaning of freedom in America.
Well, and one of the interesting things that you chronicle is that as this started to play out, researchers treated black and white criminality differently, that for blacks, criminality was evidence of an innate inferiority, if you will. But whites were treated, and I think the term was, as the great unfortunates.
That's right, the great army of unfortunates. So one of the terrific moments that occurs in the late 19th century is the confluence of the emergence of social science and sociology in particular and the Second Industrial Revolution. So this is a moment where the capacity of America to employ unskilled workers far exceeds the number of unskilled workers, which opens the floodgates of immigration, bringing a million European immigrants, usually Southern and Eastern European origin, to the United States. But that also produces a bit of a social crisis in these big cities. So there's the work is not stable. There aren't living wages. There's no collective bargaining that we come to know in the context of the post-New Deal period, which means there's a lot of crime and violence in communities where people are marginal and trying to make the best of a difficult situation. So the progressives who become the voice of reform, of urban reform in this moment, begin to see the evidence of criminality amongst working class whites and European immigrants as symptomatic of class inequality in America, as symptomatic of nativism and xenophobia, where everyone doesn't get an equal chance to participate. It's in that precise moment that the language and discourse of black people as criminals is serving a kind of white supremacist narrative that legitimizes Jim Crow, but black people live in those cities too. And so in the same space in Chicago, Detroit, New York, Philadelphia, black people's criminality is fueling a discourse of pathology, of racializing African Americans as different and deficient, while at the same time the evidence of high rates of criminality and poverty among whites is fueling a class narrative that ultimately is about transforming society.
This is the issue that whites were more easily assimilable into mainstream white culture, but there was something that was keeping blacks from ever being able to assimilate in the same way.
Well, yes, that's how it was articulated, but we don't want to put the cart before the horse. So the discourse of an army of unfortunates set aside the language of black people are their own worst enemies actually makes possible the mythology that European immigrants are more assimilable. This is the actual making of a white supremacist notion that Americanization and assimilation is about white people, a form of white privilege institutionalized that we know today. This is when it's being worked out, when it's actually being invented in a contemporary industrial moment. So ultimately, they gave resources to teach English, to provide quality, though debatable, compulsory education for European immigrants, provided a network of social service agencies and a social infrastructure, while at the same time redlining black people out of those resources. So then to then come and say that these groups are more assimilable, well, that is actually putting a circular argument based on the choices, the policy choices that had already been made.
They're more assimilable because we're giving them more opportunity to assimilate.
Correct.
One of the key figures who emerges in your recounting of this period is a man named Frederick Hoffman. Who was he and why did his analysis in particular play such a large role in how society was viewing the place of African Americans in the broader context?
Well, he's like the Alexis de Tocqueville of this moment. He's a German immigrant to the United States in 1884. Unlike de Tocqueville, he doesn't have the credentials and is not essentially a well-known foreign observer, but he creates a space for himself to see things in the demographics of the industrial moment with regard to race that others just had not noticed. He's one of the first people to document high rates of suicide in our nation's cities, something that had not been the focus of national discussion. And he also essentially stumbles upon the census data that shows that African Americans in 1890 were 30% of the nation's prisoners, but only 12% of the population. Now, on the face of it, it's not clear what we would make of that. We could see it as symptomatic of convict leasing and chain gangs and the criminalization of Southern blacks in the South, or we could see it as evidence of a kind of problem of freedom that black people don't quite know the rules of the road. Either way, Hoffman creates the blueprint for the interpretation of what that number meant. And his interpretation was that this is unimpeachable evidence that black people actually are predisposed to crime if left to their own devices. And that's significant not just because he innovated the framework for that. It's significant because he did it in a colorblind way. He did it from the perspective of being a paid actuarial for Prudential Life Insurance located in Newark, New Jersey. He did it from the perspective of being an outsider to race relations as a person who was of European origin, who was an immigrant, who had no blood on his hands from the Civil War. He also did it from the perspective of the North, which is a big deal. He says, listen, people in the North fought for black freedom. And if it turns out there are higher rates of criminality in a place like Newark or Chicago in the early 20th century, then it must be something wrong with black people and not whites.
But he jumps to this conclusion without necessarily any academic credentials to back it up.
Well, this is a period where most people don't have these kinds of academic credentials. He's writing this in 1896. Sociology is not really even founded. So the nation's leading sociology department for urban analysis becomes the Chicago School of Sociology, and it's not yet even known as the Chicago School of Sociology. It opens in 1892. So he's able to innovate in a moment where his perspective becomes the baseline for other scholars to look at. I'll give you one very quick example. The very first textbook on American criminology is written by a scholar named Charles R. Henderson. In the first edition of his book, he doesn't cite Frederick Hoffman. In the second edition of his book, which comes out after Hoffman's book, he cites Hoffman as the foremost authority on the question of black criminality. That's how significant Hoffman was. Hoffman also lives a long time. He becomes what is known as the dean of American homicide statistics. Think about this. Here's a man who comes to national attention with a prescription about black people that is all doom and gloom, that they're not capable of incorporation because of their crime problem, and yet he is the leading authority on American homicide statistics before the federal government records and collects such data, which doesn't happen until the 1930s. So he's an incredibly significant figure.
What kind of research was being done to counter what Frederick Hoffman's conclusions were at that time? How many researchers were taking a contrarian eye towards it?
Most were not. Most were swept away by the elegance of the claim. And by that I mean this statistical evidence seemed to dispel a lot of the soft racial science that had preceded it. So some of it was just, well, because black people had been enslaved, therefore they're inferior. Well, that didn't pass muster for some people. Others were biological scientists who had measured the size of black people's brains compared to those of European origin, and by their own standards, they couldn't correlate brain size with intelligence. So Hoffman comes on the fore with this very elegant argument. By virtue of the behavior of black people, not their biology per se, not their physical traits, we see that when they're not touched by white people, they revert to what he called an ancestral condition. Only African Americans, by and large, began to challenge this received wisdom.
Well, and so somewhat later, uniform crime reporting statistics first came along, and they were supposed to be strictly evidence-based, if you will. How did the UCR data change how society looked at this issue?
Everyone looks to UCR data to see how each municipality is doing. So it's a big deal. When it comes on the scene in 1930, there's an internal debate that grows out of 3 decades of struggle by black sociologists and criminologists to question what crime statistics can actually tell us about black people as a race. And so in that moment, you have 2 incredibly influential criminologists, Edwin Sutherland and Thorsten Saleen, who have been charged by the federal government to help develop the uniform crime reports. In the earliest days, they wanted to give caution to what they knew would be the practice of intuiting racial inferiority based on disproportionate evidence of arrests of African Americans. And so in the very earliest reports, they put big footnotes on the early data that said you cannot compare races based on what is in the crime tables. It's also true that in the early tables, at the local level and in the federal uniform crime reports, there was a lot more focus on European immigrant groups as distinct groups. So you could look in crime data at the arrest level and see Italians, you could see the Irish, you could see Polish, you could see Jews, you could see Germans, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what happens very quickly is that the foreign-born groups become incorporated or assimilated into the white category and essentially leaves the understanding of relative crime behavior as either white, black, Indian, Mexican, and other. Now, the Indian and Mexican categories were very small demographically. So essentially, black became the uniform category for measuring deviance against a white norm. That's meaningful because if you could tell how many Italian Americans committed armed robbery or were involved in bootlegging or other forms of illegal activity, you could disparage the group for its criminality. But if you could no longer tease out Italian Americans or Irish Americans, then all you're left with is this homogenous group of whites, which becomes the uniform norm of propriety and law-abidingness.
Well, and right. And so then the only demographic group that you can tease out to ascribe anything to is blacks.
That's correct. And just as a matter of statistical, I like this to point this out. In a homogenous country where everyone is quote unquote white, you can't have disproportionate anything. Because if the norm is 100% white, then there can't be an overrepresentation of whites in prison. There can't be an overrepresentation of whites in the arrest statistics. But with a population as small as African Americans, only 12% today, but in some of these cities, these northern cities at the time, it was 5, 6, 7%, you can have huge statistical disproportions because it's a very small population.
How influential do you think this body of work that started a century ago is today in how society views African Americans in crime?
Well, I would say that all of the thinking, the language, the ideas that circle around these conversations about black people and criminality, all of that is tied to this earlier moment. Just like the wiring in this building owes a debt to the inventions of Thomas Edison and Louis Latimer, so too are these ideas still very much a part of the infrastructure of the late 19th century. This is one part of U.S. history, not the issue of racism in the criminal justice system as a general category, but to the point of the statistical narratives about black people as criminal or pathological that we've just simply not dealt with. And so we're no more evolved today on this topic than we were back then.
Even if we as a society don't necessarily think of it in terms of inferiority, something racially inferior about African Americans leading to crime, it's all rooted in this original notion.
Well, let me be even clearer. Most people today articulate notions of black people's criminality based on what? Based on statistics. And so the disproportionate evidence of black people committing crimes, whether it's inner city violence, whether it's drugs, or even in-school suspensions, the facts are tied to the statistics, which is to say we're no different than Frederick Hoffman in saying because of the statistical evidence that we see of disproportionate offending, black people have a crime problem. Evidence of disproportionate criminality does not have to equal pathologization, does not have to equal inferiority. So therefore, we are stuck with Hoffman's formulation rather than the intervention that progressives made that said, actually, high rates of criminality are telling us something about economic insecurity and inequality when we have white populations. But a black population, which is 10% of the population, which was always a source of some form of white supremacist backlash or at least racial ambivalence, well, maybe we can lock up the entire black population and hence makes possible in a deindustrialized world where we don't need black labor, the possibilities for mass incarceration, which is what we have today.
Do you think those years of this attitude that it inherently criminalized blacks, have they been internalized at all by the black community itself?
Absolutely. And I think many people would agree. But that actually works against the argument of an economic insecurity problem or the need for robust socialization. In fact, since the days of W.E.B. Du Bois has been an argument of internalized racism. And in fact, the internalized racism argument, though it comes from the perspective of people who have a structural critique, say that people have accepted the white supremacist arguments of black pathology and now have turned on themselves and their community, that becomes an excuse for what? A cultural renaissance. It becomes an excuse for saying, well, we've got to change the thinking of people. But that's not going to change the economic insecurity that was the primary focus of the attention of the policymakers and the social reformers of the early period that transformed the lives of working class whites and European immigrants. And so until we put that back on the table in a sustained and enduring way, we're going to be left basically telling black people that, well, we know that racism has something to do with this problem, but ultimately it's your problem to fix.
Well, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad's book is called The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America, published by Harvard University Press. Muhammad is director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. He was in Milwaukee this week to speak at Marquette University as one of the school's Ralph Metcalf chairs this semester. A quick break now, and then a new report looks with some alarm at the quality of after-school programs in Milwaukee County. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Since 2012, centers that provide after-school programs in Wisconsin have been subject to evaluations and ratings by YoungStar, Wisconsin's child care rating program. And Milwaukee County's programs are struggling to keep up with standards, according to a report just out from the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. Forum President Rob Henkin spoke with WUWM's Bob Bach about this latest in a series of research reports the group has undertaken to study early childhood and after-school programs here.
What is interesting is that the state has developed a relatively new program called YoungStar, which is a quality ratings improvement program that is designed to rate early childhood care providers and after-school providers per a series of criteria that are aimed at getting at their quality, making this information available to parents, and using this as a means not only to promote enhanced quality, but as a means of better empowering parents to choose high-quality providers.
And the greater number of stars that a program receives, the higher the reimbursement from the state. Is that how it works?
That is correct. There's a carrot and stick approach here. So not only are the providers rated on a series from 1 to 5 stars, but their reimbursement under the Wisconsin Shares Child Care Subsidy Reimbursement Program are predicated on the number of stars. So 4 or 5 star providers actually get higher percentages, bonus payments. 3-star providers receive the same payment that they would have otherwise received prior to the adoption of YoungStar. 2-star providers actually receive a 5% cut in their subsidy payment, and those that are ranked 1-star are actually deemed ineligible to participate in Wisconsin Shares.
And according to your research, on average, how many programs are receiving how many stars?
Well, so what we did in this report was we really wanted to hone in on after-school providers. Now, there's some overlap. There are some traditional daycare centers that provide after-school care as well, but there's also a considerable number of programs that are essentially exclusively geared toward providing care to school-age children after school in organized settings. And we wanted to take a look at how the YoungStar rating system, which has now been applied to after school as well as early childhood care providers, how that was playing out in Milwaukee County in terms of the ratings. Some very interesting findings emerge. We found, first of all, that nearly 3/4 of the school-age programs that have been rated so far have received 2-star ratings, and that's compared to 42% of group child care centers. Furthermore, fewer than 1% of school-age programs have received ratings of 4 or 5 stars, and that's compared to about 16% of group child care centers. So it raises the question, are the quality of these after-school providers, is that quality really lacking, or are there other things going on here in terms of the applicability of the rating system that was designed first and foremost for traditional daycare type centers, is that being appropriately applied to after school settings, or is there a bigger problem here with regard to quality?
Is there any way to answer those questions?
Well, it's difficult, but what we tried to do was really then dig deeper into one of the important sets of criteria for the YoungStar ratings, and that is staff education requirements. What we found was that overwhelmingly, where the after-school providers were having difficulty in terms of meeting the requirements for 3, 4, or 5 stars was with regard to the educational credentials of their staff. And when you look at that, you see that, you know, there are some challenges here. Given the fact that these care positions are part-time in nature for the most part. There are difficulties in terms of attracting staff with higher educational credentials and furthermore with putting in the investment that is necessary either from the perspective of individual care providers or from the perspective of the organizations that are providing the care. One of those two entities has to invest in the coursework, et cetera, that's required to meet the educational levels, and doing that for part-time staff is challenging.
Where does this leave parents, do you think? Are they left seeking basically a monitoring situation, almost like a babysitting situation with virtually no enrichment attached to it, or is it not quite that dire?
We've done some other research into that factor. We held focus groups with parents to try to determine what is most important to you in terms of the after-school programs that you are choosing for your children. As you say, is educational enrichment a higher priority than perhaps receiving supplemental arts education or physical education? Are you looking for somebody who essentially is going to, for lack of a better term, babysit as opposed to, again, enrich? We found that there are different definitions of quality when it comes to what parents are looking for. You know, safety and convenience are two key criteria that parents have that maybe aren't reflected as much in the Young Star rating system. And I think that has some bearing on whether, again, the question is whether the system and the ratings criteria need to be tweaked as opposed to do we need to somehow come up with the wherewithal to invest more heavily in educational development for after-school program staff. But bottom line is, if the purpose here is to ensure that parents are able to select highly rated programs, the fact is that there aren't many highly rated after-school providers in Milwaukee County. So that would indicate that either the system needs to be tweaked or, again, that something has to be done in terms of improving the quality of these providers.
What do you hope this report will do?
What we wanted to do was simply say, here's what the data is telling us. The fact is that when we look at the landscape of after-school providers in Milwaukee County that are participating in the Milwaukee Shares program, we are finding that the three-quarters of those providers are not receiving proficient ratings. And so I think that does lead to an imperative for policymakers to dig deeper into why that is and, again, to determine a course of action to hopefully ensure that we do have a larger base of highly rated providers for parents to choose.
Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Rob Henkin is president of the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. He spoke with Bob Bach. And you can find a link to the group's report on the quality of after-school programs in Milwaukee County from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Milwaukee is one of a handful of communities taking part in a new self-assessment effort. We'll learn what that means in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Starting tonight, for 5 Wednesdays, people will gather on Milwaukee's northwest side to discuss what it means and what it takes to thrive in Milwaukee. The exercise is not an idle one. Milwaukee, along with Portland, Oregon, Richmond, Virginia, and Orlando, Florida, was selected by the University of Virginia Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture to embark on the Thriving Cities Project. Over a 5-year period, it will fold in a total of 10 cities. Their accumulated feedback will help design what organizers say will be, quote, a new method of community assessment. David Flowers is the local coordinator and will pull together Milwaukee's profile. Catherine Wilson is with the Frank Zeidler Center for Public Discussion and will coordinate the focus group series. The two met with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz at the center's office at Redeemer Lutheran Church at 19th and Wisconsin. You'll learn its significance later. Flowers says he fell into the project when University of Virginia sociologist Josh Yates telephoned his graduate advisor.
I was a graduate student at Marquette, and my advisor works with the Community Transformation Project out of Marquette, and I just happened to be in his office one day when Josh called, and the two of them had known each other from previous meetings, and Josh was looking for somebody to write the profile for Milwaukee, and I just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
To get back to Josh, Josh came to Milwaukee. When I was hearing Josh give his intro to the project and then found out that David was going to be the lead person, I just extended the Zeidler Center's process and our services to both of them, just thinking that it would be a good fit.
So, Catherine, talk about the center.
Well, it began in 2006. It was formed out of a vision from Frank Zeidler, the mayor of Milwaukee, and members of Redeemer Lutheran Church. And it was started as a volunteer organization, and his vision was to create safe spaces that people who held vastly different opinions about key issues related to the city and the nation could come together and speak to each other and really hear and be heard by people that they would normally feel very threatened to be in the same room with. So since then, we've facilitated both public dialogues throughout the year on various issues and also private dialogues with organizations around the city. We also train facilitators to go out within their neighborhoods and use the methodology.
What is the methodology?
The methodology, in a nutshell, it was created by the Public Conversations Project out of Boston, and what it is a structured and facilitated dialogue, which means that each part of the dialogue is intentional, and we meet in a large group, and then we split into small groups, and each of those small groups has a facilitator. And there are a series of rounds, and the first three rounds of the dialogue, participants are asked a specific question. The question that the facilitator asks tries to get people to speak about a key issue from a personal experience. So not abstract, not kind of a soapbox discussion, but this is a personal experience that I had. The second round has to do with getting participants to articulate the heart of the matter for themselves, their deepest held values. So the question, whatever the question is, we'll try to gear towards that. And the third round is asking a question that gets participants to articulate the complexity of their own view where they might have gray areas, mm-hmm. especially when you're dealing with people who might otherwise demonize or dehumanize each other, or they all believe this, or you are all evil or bad. To hear somebody sit across from you and speak about their own insecurities, their own vulnerabilities within their position, it's much more difficult to stereotype and dehumanize them after that dialogue. In those rounds, there's no crosstalk. The process is intentionally slow, whereas debate, you're just waiting for your turn to speak. We intentionally slow the process down, so we include a lot of listening. And so it's really exciting for me to be involved in this project.
You'll have, what, six sessions over the coming?
Yes.
Okay. And the first topic is arts and architecture. Is that
yes.
right? So what's controversial about that?
Well, what's exciting about the Thriving Cities focus groups is that they're not necessarily controversial topics. Some of the participants said, well, I have strong opinions about what's going right. But I think that where this methodology can lend itself is that it's not about creating consensus. It is about maintaining difference and allowing others to hear and come in contact with that difference. Even when they're talking about what's happening right or where the city is thriving, I often think that we still operate often in silos, and we're not seeing. There's so many nonprofits working in this city, and often duplicating work, and to actually hear where other people are working in an attempt not to come to some consensus, but just wow, this is perhaps a little bit different. Your mission or this shifting, I think that can be really beneficial.
Will each focus group stand alone, or will one build upon the other? Are you hoping that people will come session after session?
We are hoping for a new group each week. I think it might be helpful to back up a little bit and talk about what the final product of this whole five-year study is. What we're hoping to create is an assessment tool, a citywide assessment tool based on examining what is thriving, what is going well, where do people flourish in a city? In contrast to many assessment tools that measure what's going wrong. It's also based in a notion of cities not as institutions or a hierarchical structure where things are managed from on high. It's more of a notion that cities are a standalone human ecology. if you will, where if we go back to the 1840s leading up to today, Milwaukee is seen as an ecosystem that shows up in the world in a particular way with particular gifts and particular issues, rather than having this notion of experts telling us how we need to live our lives here, that we really interact very on a daily basis with one another and create a shared understanding of what it means to live here in this city as human beings. So getting back to this assessment tool, how do we break down and notice in the realm of the arts or in the realm of our economics or in the realm of the way we view justice or the way we taking a look at that is the fact that we are all completely interconnected and rely on one another to create meaning around those topics. So if you mentioned that this doesn't sound very controversial, people thinking of themselves in this city as thriving participants is kind of a controversial notion.
Obviously, there's lots of good things going on in Milwaukee, but one neighborhood may feel they're living that thriving, that good stuff, yes. Whereas others may feel completely, you know, they might as well be on a different planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of the work I see this tool points toward is contradicting these notions of isolation, that we are somehow alone or not working together or that we are not part of something more greater than ourselves and more complex. That's why getting back again to this notion of moral ecology, of human ecology, that we are totally connected and that the decisions and viewpoints that I have great effect on my neighbor. So, you know, I found a lot of the work I'm doing really has to do with helping people notice one another. And I think that's where we dovetails well with the Zeidler Center. So I really see it as a byproduct of these focus groups, people just getting to know one another and becoming aware of the good things they share with one another.
Is there an optimal number of people with whom that can work just logistically? And
well, we are limiting these focus groups to 15 people per endowment. So that will be three groups of five when we split into the small groups. With the Zeidler Center, our public dialogues and some of our private dialogues involve up to 100 people. So it's not that we can't handle a large group. I think that the intention is to invite people who, you know, for example, in the realm of justice, who would have something to say. Not everyone in the city will know what's thriving in terms of the just and well-ordered. So we want to be targeting those people who will be able to speak to these endowments, which is why we're limiting it to 15 people. So space is limited. Register today. ZeidlerCenter.org.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. You can go to ZeidlerCenter.org, and there will be a link to the Thriving Cities focus groups. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of information there that will assist you in deciding which focus group you'd like to participate in.
Can people watch this? Is it interactive in some way, or are you going to be compiling all this through the weeks?
Focus groups will not be filmed. Some of our other dialogues are made more public and filmed, but these focus groups, we want people to feel like they're in a safe place to be honest about what's happening. And so what happens in the small groups is usually confidential, and people... We have certain communication agreements that the participants agree to in advance, and one of those is that they'll maintain confidentiality if requested. So his report won't be naming names unless they agree to be named.
Yes, the final product from the focus groups will look like a report that will be available to people. And with regard to the profile I'm writing about Milwaukee will show up as an appendix to that profile, but it will strongly inform the thinking and writing that goes into each of the endowments that will be discussed in the profile of Milwaukee.
And then back at University of Virginia, will each of the four cities report stand alone, or is there some commonality that will be?
In June, we're coming together, the four cities, as well as there's also two or three scholars, doctoral students most typically, on the East Coast that are each writing topic papers on each of the endowments, just in a general way. So there will be a large gathering in June of, I'm guessing, 25 or 30 people who will look at this and these various papers, and there will probably be rewrites. And at this point, it's a second year of a five-year process.
So the two of you have been working together on this just a matter of months,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
What do you think you bring to this process? What do you see happening already?
I'm having a lot of fun. Dr. Catherine Wilson, she's skillful and disciplined. I'm skillful and not so disciplined sometimes. Catherine will, I can tell sometimes from just one quick nod whether I'm on track or not. I can give an example. My first reaction to doing this interview was, oh, no, we can't tell the city about this project yet. I'm not ready. And Catherine literally looked me in the eye, and her first response was, are you crazy? The Lake Effect listenership is exactly the kind of people we want. And I said, well, you know, she's right.
And so, then you ran to his office and emailed, you have got to be crazy. You write her back right now. And you invite her to go speak to the good.
Yes.
Or the true. You are invited.
David Flowers is coordinating the Thriving Cities Project in Milwaukee. Catherine Wilson is executive director of the Frank Zeidler Center for Public Discussion. She'll be facilitating six focus groups, starting with this evening's discussion of arts and architecture. There's more at WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Now, before you get out that ramen you were going to make for lunch, keep listening because our dining critic tells us where they're taking the humble noodle dish up a notch when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Anyone who has ever supported themselves going through college has probably found themselves stockpiling 39-cent packages of ramen noodles to get them through the end of the month. You know, you had the oriental flavor, and you had the chicken flavor, and sometimes the beef flavor. But the ramen noodles you'll find at Milwaukee area restaurants these days are definitely a cut above. In fact, these dishes might just be reclaiming the image of ramen, which wasn't always cheap and sodium-intensive. Lake Effect Dining contributor Ann Christensen and our Dan Harmon noodled the idea of why ramen is seemingly ubiquitous in 2014.
A trend, it's not. I guess unless you, if you would consider it something being new or somewhat, you know, now people are developing a fascination maybe for it. That might give it the name trend, but in Japan, people have been eating ramen, various kinds, different sorts of broth, different, you know, maybe different noodles, different additions to it for a very long time.
Why is it all of a sudden so popular? Did one restaurant in the country or city decide that they're going to just publicize the daylights out of it and it caught on?
Well, sort of.
Yeah.
In New York City, ramen's been pretty big for a long time. You might be familiar with a restaurant called Momofuku.
Mm-hmm.
Owner is David Chang, who's pretty famous. And he's written about his travels through Japan and eating ramen in Japan. And, you know, he's a well-known chef now and has been doing this in New York City. And there's a lot of places in New York to get ramen. As we often hear, you know, it takes a little while for certain things to filter from the bigger cities to Milwaukee, just the nature of things. And so now people have been saying, well, OK, well, why don't we have ramen here? I mean, in Vietnamese restaurants, you can get pho, which is really, you know, a Vietnamese soup. And ramen in many ways is a soup. You know, why don't we have this here? So the one place where you're here, I mean, you're starting to hear more about it because there's a restaurant on the east side called Ardent, which opened a few months ago. They're doing a ramen special just on Friday and Saturday nights, but it's late night. So you can't just go there any old time and get ramen. It's late night, but it's the really good pork broth. It's called tonkatsu. And that is this the particular kind of ramen that he's doing, which is really rich, very sort of a decadent, almost milky broth. It comes from a lot of the fat, the meat, and the bone. And it's super delicious, you know, and you put noodles in there and you have various additions to it, vegetables and so on. And it's a full meal, you know. And some people, they don't have that idea or concept of what it is until they order it and how delicious it is and how filling this thing. And it really is a meal. And so just people are sort of thinking about, okay, so Justin Carlisle, the owner of Arden, is sort of, you know, bringing a little more attention to that. Then at the same time, there's a restaurant, new restaurant in Shorewood that has replaced the Inaba Tea Room in the garden room, not the old garden room, the garden room, and it's called Tochi, and they're doing Japanese ramen as well. However, the style of ramen they're doing is different from the style that Arden is doing. This one, there's various styles that they're doing actually. One of them is also a brothless version, which is so it's more noodle based, not a lot of broth in there. Pork belly. There might be a deviled egg on there. They've got one that has it has grass fed beef on these noodles as well as a bone marrow compound butter. So that place is doing it. And then you're hearing of other places. For example, the National in Walker's Point, I think you're just going to start to see more of this happening, more interest in it. Sort of like pho, it sort of grew a little bit. And I suppose in that way, there's a bit of a trend element to it.
So just as a reference point, how different is this from what we all had in college or people still do have in college? How different is this from
the package? It's vastly different. It's vastly different.
All right.
And a lot better. I, had this little joke with someone in our office who is older, and he said, yeah, those 15-cent packages of ramen. And I said, it's not 15 cents anymore. It's more like 60 cents. He thought that was sort of highway robbery, I suppose. You know, as opposed to having these, the packaged ramen with the almost powdered seasoning, and you add water to it. I mean, we're talking about something that's made from scratch here, where you're cooking down the bones of, the pork bones and things like this. So clearly it's going to make a huge difference between that and some instant stuff. Okay. It should.
Yeah, I should hope so. How is it different from, for example, an udon or other noodle bowls in
right,
Japanese?
That's a good question. Yeah. The noodles themselves are different. The broth is different. And the toppings can be very different.
Is it lighter, heavier? Is it just
different?
It
can be both. Yeah. It can be either, rather. It can be heavier or it can be lighter. I was in California recently and had an extremely rich one. Again, this is the tonkatsu version, where the broth is almost, it's almost opaque. It's very rich with a lot of meat in it. And with the noodles and you add like an egg in there and you add, mushrooms and maybe bamboo shoots or, whatever, seaweed, things you want to add, it becomes incredibly rich and filling and not light at all, really.
Okay. So we talked about the 15 or now 60 cent bags of ramen. So what's a typical price range for this kind of restaurant ramen?
That's a good question. If you go to Ardent, I believe you can get a bowl of ramen and a beer for $10.
All right.
If you go to Tochi, depending on what style of ramen and what the additions are, it might be like $9 up to 13, something along those lines.
But not including a beer?
No.
Or
a sake.
All right. So I want to talk to you, our second topic today and last one, I think, is about it's a new offering from you in the magazine about chefs and their refrigerators. Tell us about that.
It's a monthly column. It started about 3 months ago. It's something I've been wanting to do for a long time because I think more than ever people are curious about chefs, right? Chefs a lot of them are famous. They're rock stars. People want to know not only do they want to know what they're cooking in the restaurant, they want to know about their personal lives, right? It's become so gossipy in a way, people wanting to know about chefs.
And here we are.
And here we are. And I think, not only are they curious about chefs and how things work, the inner workings of the restaurant kitchen, I think they like to know, well, what do chefs eat when they're not working? Or what do they cook? What's in their refrigerators? And I know from talking to chefs on the phone that a lot of them don't spend a lot of time at home. And they might have frozen pizzas in their freezer and a refrigerator full of condiments. So you definitely have those. And I think that chef refrigerator, this is what we're calling this new column, is an interesting place where you might have might feature a chef whose refrigerator is like that, just full of condiments, because that particular chef picks up a lot of takeout and doctors it up with condiments. Or you might have a chef who cooks and genuinely has you know, I don't know, vegetables or, you know, some kind of like a pot of stew or some kind of homemade soda. You know, maybe they also have an interest in cocktails and there's something like that in their refrigerator. Or, you know, who knows, like Limburger cheese, like super stinky cheese. I think it's just a really interesting way of you know, getting at like a little bit more of a personal element about a chef without getting that personal. So what we did is we send our staff photographer over to the chef refrigerator's house, their home, and I asked the chefs not to clean the refrigerator first, not to go specialty shopping. You know, obviously I can't stop them from doing that, but I asked them not to. And so our photographer takes photos of the interior of the refrigerator. I see once he comes back, shows me those photos, then I call the chef and chat with them about it.
All right. Well, so the one that I'm looking at right now looks so well organized, I find it hard to believe that it's real.
Really?
That's just my initial impression of it, yeah.
Okay. Well,
that's one organized chef.
This one happens to be, can I mention this?
Yeah.
Cameron Roberts, one of the owners of Cafe Lulu and Juniper 61. And actually, it's, I think it's more stacky. There's a lot of things stacked on top of each other. Vegetables and leftovers and packages of meat and things of that nature.
I wonder how many of them you're going to find have leftovers from the restaurant.
Yes, many, many.
Oh, really? Okay. That's allowed. All right.
I think it's okay.
All right. Well, any surprises so far?
In Chef Refrigerator?
Yeah. Anything that you have found in there that they've forgotten to take out?
Of course. Yes. Yes. That's what I'm always... I'm looking for mold is what I'm looking for.
Hmm. All right.
I don't know. I'm holding out hope. I don't know that I'm ever going to find that. I'm kidding.
All right. Okay, Ann. Thank you for coming on. I'll talk to you next month.
Thanks, Dan.
Ann Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine and writes the Dish on Dining column for its website. She is also our regular dining contributor, and she spoke with Dan Harmon. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, a leading media ethicist explains why we should all be thinking about ethics in journalism, even if we're only posting pictures on Facebook. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.